about Yom Yerushalayim. I'm not going to be here towards next week. I won't be here. Mirtha Shalom will be in the States for yeshiva stuff. And Yom Yerushalayim comes out this year on a Sunday, so it's really, you hit it right after Shabbos. I do want through you to stress the importance of trying to be involved in Yom Yerushalayim activities, in particular, davening batikin at the Kotel. I mean, it's just one of the highlights of the year, the whole yeshiva together, Rosh Yeshiva. And this is a little bit easier because it's really a two-day Yom Yerushalayim festivity because of Shabbos, so most of the country is going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim on Sunday night. So a lot of the non-yeshiva activities will take place Sunday night, but the yeshiva is going to celebrate a Matzah Shabbos during the Sunday, so you really don't have that conflict. Should I be part of the yeshiva events? Should I be part of some of the national events that you'll hear about? So obviously you want to make sure you're in the best matters also, but what I want to talk with you about is not how you schedule that. I'm sure you'll find out all the scheduling availabilities, but what are we really celebrating, and how to wrap your heads around Yom Yerushalayim? And I hope that some of the things I've discussed with Yom HaAtzmaut and Yom HaZikaron were meaningful, but at least Yom HaAtzmaut is a day that you really did have some awareness in Chutz La'aretz. Yom HaZikaron, perhaps you had awareness, it wasn't as potent as it was here. I imagine that in many cases Yom Yerushalayim is just noted. You say Hallel, maybe a falafel for lunch, or something of that ilk, but to really latch onto what the day means, and what the day means in Eretz Yisrael. And to a degree, it's interesting because sociologically, Yom Yerushalayim is obviously not celebrated or marked by Haredim. It's also very, very infrequently celebrated or marked by Chilonim as opposed to Yom HaAtzmaut, because of the politicalization of this day and the events. It's really only a very small sector of society that really is aware of it, but acknowledges and embraces and celebrates it. And, you know, that's fine, obviously. There are reasons on both ends, but it's a day that has become much more infused with the Dati Lumi spirit. I want to give you three different dimensions to Yom Yerushalayim, to be able to think about it from three different standpoints, three different vantage points. The first vantage point, and to me the major thrust, and it's harder, and as time goes on, this becomes a little bit more dimmed in the rearview mirror. Excuse me for the typo on top of the page, should be Yerushalayim. It's just simply to be able to appreciate the Nisim and the Niflaos that took place. Without thinking about the symbolic importance of Yerushalayim, how the world changed in 1967, things that I'll get to. And like I said before, it's this aspect that the passage of time dims, and it's also this aspect that's not just obscured by the passage of time, but is almost vandalized. It's disfigured by political revisionism. Where are the extra sheets for guys that are coming in? Thanks, Rama. In the rearview mirror of political revisionism, the Six-Day War is cast. What happened? What are we? We're 45 years, right? 45 years from the Six-Day War. Right? 45 years ago, it was cast as if that's when it all changed. That's when Israel became occupiers. That's when the West Bank challenges began, that we had to rule over a people and solve the where to draw borders. And it's so unfortunate because in its truth, in 1967 was a miracle of unequal proportion in many respects, even unequal by 48. In 1967, let me give you a little bit of background. General Nasser, the general of Egypt, the ruler of Egypt, hurled the UN out of the Suez Canal. He evicted them from the Suez Canal. And he hurled his famous threat at Israel. And to us, it's cartoonish. You've heard the threat. You maybe even saw cartoons about it. But 67 was 19 years after the founding of the state. And those intervening years between 48 and 67 were not years of political stability, military safety, constant wars of attrition, constant terror attacks across the border from Jordan. Remember, the border with Jordan was a hot border, unlike today where that border was a Baruch Hashem, relatively safe border, constant fighting, skirmishing, small wars, small clashes, a lot of people lost their lives, not to mention people that sacrificed just to get to Yerushalayim, was taking your life into your own hands to go through that little corridor on the way up to Yerushalayim. And economically, not to mention those economic years, I mean, I'll say something that you probably didn't even learn about or study. These were years of economic rationing. You couldn't buy food, you had to have it rationed, like during wartime, like during military rule. Diplomatically, we're very isolated. This is before the United States poured significant weaponry into the state of Israel. And General Nasser gets up and announces that he's going to hurl the Jews into the sea. That's the famous, famous image. I'm going to throw the Jews into the sea. That resonates very, very deeply with Holocaust survivors 19 years after Hitler's Holocaust that ended, or 20 22 years afterwards, is, you know, we're looking at time sweeps of 40, 50, 60 years. You're looking at 20 years after the Holocaust, and when you were defenseless and vulnerable, and he threatens to, I mean, Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, would speak to us about these events every year in Yom HaShoah. It's actually an 18-minute Hebrew recording. It's up on the internet. There's an educators' conference in Israel in a few days, and they wanted to hear Rav Amital about Yom HaShoah. So the yeshiva is preparing some of his, this is one of his famous Sichon. He'll just tell us the events, having lived through it. He says he remembers living through the events and the pessimism that abounded, the fatalism almost. Women and children were sent out of the country in mass. Women and children were sent to the United States, were sent to Britain, so that whatever casualties would be inflicted upon our people, at least the women and children won't be slaughtered en masse. That's what people were expecting. Kids would come to school weeks and weeks before the Six-Day War broke out. And there was no classes, no courses, no tests, no instruction. They would open the Tehillim. They would say Tehillim for 5-6 hours and go home. That's the type of panic and the type of fear that ruled over our people in our country. People literally feared. I wouldn't say a Holocaust, because I think most military generals were game planning, hopefully. I mean, you know, military generals' job is to game plan for whatever scenario is, remote as it is. You know, you don't try to think realistically, try to think out of the box, so that in the heat of war, you've got plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E, because you don't have the time to think about different plans. You want to think about every possible crazy scheme scenario, have them all worked out, so then the heat of battle, oh, this scenario is unfolding, let's implement plan A, let's implement plan B. The Israeli generals, in their wildest moments, in their wildest dreams, didn't imagine liberating Yudan Shomron, liberating the old city, marching into the Kotel. Like, in their wildest machinations, it never dawned on them. This was a defensive war in the truest sense. All their time was occupied, the weeks leading to this war. How can we escape with limited casualties? 30,000, 40,000, 100,000. How can we limit the casualties? In their wildest dreams, unfortunately, that's why the West Bank and Yudan Shomron have become such a political hot potato, because no one really knew what to do with it. There's nothing that anyone dreamed of. If not for Ariel Sharon bringing a few bulldozers to that small little alley in front of the Kotel overnight and leveling it and creating the plaza that we now have, that would also be under debate and international pressure. Ariel Sharon seized the moment and he brought the bulldozers, but everything was stalemated because no one knew what to do with it. It was completely unarming, completely surprising. No one had any plan in place. That was the orientation. Send women and children out. Say to Hillam, how can we limit the casualties? There were no bomb shelters. People didn't even have bomb shelters in Tel Aviv. People would just go down to the basement the first night of the war, hoping that when the Egyptian Air Force would carpet bomb complete streets in Tel Aviv with impunity, that whatever buildings would be demolished or pulverized, a few people in the basement would survive. Obviously, people on the main floors would die, would be crushed to death. But that was bomb shelters. Going to the basement, maybe a few, 10 out of each building of 200 people, maybe will survive in the basement. That was the regnant attitude the weeks leading up to the Six-Day War. And then all of a sudden, people just went into those basements the first night of the war, and it's just miraculous, out of nowhere. They woke up to hear a crackling voice of the Israeli radio announcing there's no longer an Egyptian Air Force. The Egyptian Air Force has been completely eliminated. You no longer have to fear for aerial attacks. There is no longer an Egyptian Air Force. Israel surprise attacked the Egyptian Air Force on the tarmac. And all of a sudden, as the war unfolded, and again, this was pre-American assistance, and pre-73 was driven by the weaponry and the arming of our people in a larger Cold War geopolitical dynamic. This is just, you take a look and you read the psukim, you know, the psukim in Malachim Beis, and I'm always crying when I hear these psukim, because I can't forget Rav Amital reading these psukim to us. Look at the first source. It's really the only source on this section. In the 15th year of Amatzia ben Yoash, as you know, the Jewish kingdom was divided in two. The north was ruled by the 10 Shvatim. Capital was Shomron. By and large, wicked kings. The southern kingdom, Yudah ben Yamin. Capital is Yushalayim. So Amatzia ben Yoash has already been ruling 15 years for Yehuda. The northern king is Yeravam ben Yoash. He's the northern king. He ascends the throne. Now don't confuse Yerovam ben Yoash with the nefarious Yerovam ben Nevat, the one who was an idolater, a paganist, and a murderer. This is a different Yerovam ben Yoash, but look carefully, the Pasuk affiliates his behavior. Source number Aleph, line 2, Vayas hara ben Hashem. Yerovam ben Yoash was just as wicked, just as disobedient. Losar, line 3, Mikol chatos Yerovam ben Nevat. He was just as his administration maintained all the policies of Yerovam ben Nevat. So basically you're dealing with a Yerovam ben Nevat personality. So what happens during the reign of this wicked king in the north? Huay Shev, line 3, is Gevul Yisrael Milavach Hamas Ad Yam Harava. He led to grand territorial expansion. All of a sudden, Israel's borders extended until the Mediterranean Sea. Kidvar Hashem, I think we need another sheet up here, Shlomo. Shlomo, I need another sheet. Kidvar Hashem, as Hashem had prophesied, Asher Diber, Biad Abdo, Yonah ben Amitai. Thanks, Ezra. Just one sheet. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu had prophesied to Yonah ben Amitai, Hashem Migat Hefer. Yonah ben Amitai lived during this period. He was contemporaneous. Look at what's happening. A wicked, evil, disobedient, paganistic, perhaps murderous king. Yerovam ben Nevat was a murderer. We don't know that about Yerovam ben Yoash, but there's an equity, there's an equality here. The Tanakh's equating the two. All of a sudden, this wicked king is leading to grand territorial expansion to the Mediterranean Sea, as God had prophesied. Why? So the pasuk continues. Ki ra Hashem esani Yisrael marem miod. Hashem saw the plight of the Jewish people was bitter. V'efes atzur. No one to stop invasion. Efes azuv. No one to help. Eino zer li Yisrael. No allies. V'lo diber Hashem limchos Hashem Yisrael mitachas Hashemayim. And Hashem refused to allow the Jewish people to be exterminated. Rav Amital, we always quote these psukim to us as a gloss of what's happening in 67. 67, we had no allies. 67, the UN was evicted from the Suez Canal. 67, America didn't rush to our defense. 67, we were literally on the brink of extinction. 67, he hurled that threat to throw you into the sea, and it was a threat that resonated. The gallows humor of 1967, I still remember hearing this joke, so to speak, this gallows humor. When I showed up in this country in 83, what was the line, Josh, to see your mouth thing? The last person to leave Ben-Gurion should shut the lights. You know, last person out of the house, make sure the lights are off. That's what people fear, that it would come down to the last Jew leaving Israel. Just make sure you close things up before you leave our country. That's what people feared. And we had no allies, and our predicament was vulnerable and indefensible. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in 6 days, images and dreams and visions that Hayinu Kachalim, we could only imagine dreaming about. You can only imagine dreaming of that. We're no longer threatened by the Egyptian Air Force. Do you know how desperately Israel pleaded with King Hussein of Jordan not to join the war? We're fighting the Syrians to the north and the Egyptians to the south. We have no beef with you. This is not your war, King Hussein. Don't attack us. You won't be attacked. We're too busy. This is not an issue with you. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, General Nasser, whose divisions are being surrounded in the Sinai by Israeli troops, sends a telegraph to King Hussein saying, our Egyptian tanks are marching on Ashdod and on Ashkelon and on Tel Aviv. Come join the war. Open up a flank to the east and you'll join in the spoils of war and we'll give you some of the land of these Zionists. A total lie. Total fabrication. Egyptian divisions were not marching on Ashdod and Ashkelon. They were being defeated in the Sinai desert. And somehow that day, the Rabbanu Shalom intervened in the heart of King Hussein, as he does, Asher Salalti bin Mitzrayim. And Hussein is duped by General Nasser, and he jumps into the war, and just within 2-3 days, simply unspeakable visions. Har Habayis Biadenu, HaKotel Biadenu, blowing shofar at the Kotel, soldiers going down to the Kotel, the heartland of Jewish history, Beit Lechem, Shechem, Hebron, Beit El. This is where Jewish history unfolded. Jewish history did not unfold on the coast. This is where the Akedah is, where Avram traveled to. This is where we live. This is where Jewish history was hatched and born. Don't even imagine returning to these lands. It was the furthest things in people's imagination. This is a defensive war. And that's really the first type of experience to try to tap into. Before you talk about the symbolic meaning of Yerushalayim, or how the world was changed after 1967, simply need some influence. There are people, not too many, but there are people and there are shittos that say you should not say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. For whatever reasons, and I don't want people getting wrapped up around that issue. You could be the biggest Zionist in the world and not say halal because you feel that I feel halal, you shouldn't. And you could be, you know, in theory, someone who's an anti-Zionist against the state and but still feel that the nisim are great enough to warrant halal. People get so wrapped up around the formal question. Don't forget the formal question. There may be halachic issues, and everyone deals with halachic issues differently. But just to show you the different dimensions of Yom Yerushalayim, there is a sheet there of Unterman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who is one of the Rav HaRashi of Eretz Yisrael, who felt you should not say halal on Yom HaTzmaut, not say halal, not say halal with the bracha, I forget which one, but whatever it was, you should say either halal or halal with the bracha on Yom Yerushalayim, because the magnitude of Nisan that occurred was simply one that surpassed, that superseded whatever miracles, as significant as they were. The miracles of 48, I'll talk about this a little bit later, you know, they were a little bit flawed. They were UN brokered, you know, there's an armistice, basically no advance, nothing really changed. We just defended our positions. It was groundbreaking, it was historic. But the Nisan people really felt. You talk to even to secular Jews who lived during that experience as if Mashiach could have come. As if that was an era, that was an opening, that was a horizon, that was a window. And if somehow history had turned differently, 67 could have been Yimos HaMashiach. Now we believe it could be Eschalta de Gula, but that's already a whole different arc. That could be hundreds of years, thousands. But it could have been an imminent return, and somehow history didn't evolve that way. But just to feel the Yad Hashem, and the Ashkacha practice, and just that people's lives were spared, not 10 lives, not 100 lives, but hundreds of thousands potential casualties. Zehayom, if you're able to say Zehayom, Asa Hashem, Nagila V'nisma Chavo, there's a day that you're experiencing 25 years ago, in which thousands of years after Nevuah, thousands of years after Beis HaMikdash, thousands of years after Yitzias Mitzrayim, Zehayom, Asa Hashem, Nagila V'nisma Chavo, that should mean something to you, and to a degree. The miracles that have taken place over the last 65 years, or more or less 66 years, they're not as stark, they're not as bold, they're not as concentrated, they're not as pitched, but I don't know, you calculate how many rockets have been fired on our people over the last 10 years, and rockets per casualty, I think you'll come to an extremely, Baruch Hashem, extremely, extremely, or terror incidents divided by casualties, right? How many terror incidents have been perpetrated on our people over the last 15 years? And I don't want to say it's an amazing figure, Chalila Lachas, because it's a very unfortunate figure. Baruch Hashem, we have the sense that our presence here is not Kol HaKavod to everything we're doing, and to Tzavan, to our ability, and to our Chayalim, and of course, but sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is constantly, constantly protecting, and Magen Avraham is still a Magen Avraham. So that's the first theme of Yom Yerushalayim. And again, you mentioned the Six-Day War. It's undergone terrible historical revisionism as if it's an imperialist war, and that's where we conquer territories or liberate, whatever terms you use. It's totally, totally untrue. And you have a responsibility to yourself and those in the next couple of years who will be with people that just don't have this. Go on the internet, read about the war, listen to the reports, hear that footage, see that footage, hear that army report where they march into Yerushalayim. Had nothing to do with any pre-plan. It was simply HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided us with some mitzia, with some undiscovered and unplanned opportunities. Obviously, the second part of Yom Yerushalayim is the broader symbolism of Yerushalayim. What does it mean? What does Yerushalayim mean in our collective consciousness? Let me share with you a Gemara and a Pasuk, and then try to help you better understand this, because I think it's also... It's difficult for rationalists, it's difficult for pragmatists. We're all pragmatists, we're all rationalists. But your pragmatism, your rationalism can't come at the price of your messianism. And how do you merge the two? How do you become a messianist to believe you're part of a messianic arc and still take practical steps, but realize that sometimes it's not about pragmatics. Not all places are created equal. There's an interesting Gemara in Brachos. We're in Brachos this summer, Daf Mem Tesim et Aleph. How do you conclude the third bracha of So we know how to conclude it. Bonei Baruch Hamavet, consistent, the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. But there's a different position. So let's see the Gemara Bracha source A, part 2 source A. Ma'u chosem b'vinyan Yerushalayim. How does that Bracha conclude? Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Moshiach Yisrael. There's a descending opinion. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, you don't speak about the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. You speak about Jewish redemption, Jewish salvation, messianism. It's a broader stroke, a broader brush. Not speaking about Yerushalayim per se, but the general theme of Jewish redemption. So the Gemara is surprised. The Gemara is astounded. Amar Lei, so I mean, line number two, Moshia Yisrael in Binyan Yushalayim. Lo. That's all you speak about, Moshia Yisrael? Can you even talk about Jewish redemption without mentioning Yushalayim? How could you even articulate a bracha that concludes with Jewish redemption without considering Yushalayim? So right away, Rabbi Yossi reviewed the backpedals. No, 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 Ela Eima, Av Moshia Yisrael, Chas V'Shalom. I would never conjugate a bracha about Jewish redemption without including Yushalayim. And what I meant is, you don't just mention Yushalayim and allude to Jewish redemption, you actually formulate Jewish redemption. The bracha should conclude, Bona Yushalayim, Umoshia Yisrael. That was Rabbi Yosef Yehuda's longer version of the bracha. We suffice with the shorter version of the bracha. Point is, you can't address Jewish redemption without factoring in a city, a place, a capital, a Beis HaMikdash, a center point, an epicenter, a stone upon which everything rests. The notion of Jewish people returning, even the notion of geographical return, has to be pinned on a place that bridges the two. And I'll get back to that pasuk in a moment, but let's take a look at source vav, as I mentioned the metaphysical part of it. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo avol b'Yushalayim shalmala, ad she'avol b'Yushalayim shalmata. I will only resuscitate and rehabilitate Yushalayim shalmala until first I will resuscitate Yushalayim shalmata. Dechsev Yushalayim habenuya. Yishalayim is a city that unites a city. We'll talk about the other meaning of this fusion. Yishalayim is a fusion. It's a fusion between humans and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's how Yishalayim got its name. Remember, there was a sect of religious people who already settled Yishalayim before Avram ever arrived on the scene. Who was the head of that sect? I talked about it earlier this year. Malki Tzedek was this priest to Kohen Le'el Elyon. And what did he call that town? Shalem, because people realized that human beings could reach perfection through religion. They wanted to become more perfect. They wanted to improve themselves. Really, the first culture to look to improve themselves, not just geographically, like the people of Migdal Bavel, but spiritually and religiously. And he was a religious leader. He was a Kohen in Parshas Lech Lecha. He settles with this group of monks or monasteries, and he builds a religious community of perfection, of striving for perfection. But what does Avram add? Avram adds to the word Shalem. What does he add to the site? The word Yeru. He visits that site in Parshas Vayera, and he introduces the notion you can't just achieve perfection by human convention. You can't just perfect yourself through human means. In order to be perfect, in order to be Shalem, you have to stand in front of Hashem, the Har Hashem Yirah. You have to walk up to the Akedah, and sometimes you reach perfection not through human ration. The Akedah is not a human rational moment. You can't make sense of the Akedah in human morality. To reach full perfection, you have to stand in front of God, beyond human ability, beyond human morality, sacrifice, ways you can't understand, ways you can't comprehend, and that's the full perfection. Yerushalayim. He takes Malki Tzedek's name, and he conjugates it, Yerushalayim. So this Shalayim is always this conjugation, is always this combination between a human city and a divine temple in Shemayim. So always this combination between what went on. Ein Zekim Beis Elokim, Yaakov says, V'zeh Shaar Shemayim. One knew that Yerushalayim, and all three major religions knew that that's where religion, monotheism, is going to emerge from. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I will not restore the heavenly spiritual input of this world until I first restore it. I won't resuscitate and repopulate my people until I rebuild Yerushalayim. Which is why we say every day in davening, source number Dalet, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidcha Yisrael Yechanes. I will build Yerushalayim and I will gather my exiled children. The two go hand in hand. Children of Israel will not be returned to their people and their homeland without Yerushalayim. The two are inseparable. And that's why, hurry back, so I want you to hear the second one. Hurry back. No, no. And that's why, and this is really the important gist. The events of 1967 were far more messianic in everyone's consciousness than the events of 48, both in the general universal consciousness as well as in the Jewish consciousness. When the Jewish people returned in 48 to their homeland, in everyone's view, this was, it was good for the world's conscience. The terrible crimes of the Holocaust had to be addressed. All these refugees had to be dealt with. The Jewish people were owed a moral debt. anti-Semitism in their minds had to be repaired, and this would be a way to repair it by giving Jews their own homeland. Falsely, but that's what people believed. Messianism didn't really emerge powerfully in the human spirit in 48. This was just an accommodation. Jews had to be accommodated. Let's parcel up the land. Let's hand certain lands to the Jews, certain lands to the Arabs. Let's have some rahmanis, some mercy, some pity on the Jewish refugees who are being ported from land to land. The return to Yerushalayim 19 years later is a messianic dimension. All of a sudden, when Jews return to their land, Jews have returned to the historical stage. We're living in Yerushalayim. We're dictating our own fate. We've returned to the land of history, not just to Tel Aviv and to Haifa and to Ashdod and to Ashkelon, but to Yerushalayim and the broader Jerusalem area of Shechem and Beit Lechem and Hebron. And all of a sudden, these psukim and these visions, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes, that's when the enthusiasm for Aliyah is kicked off. The Aliyah between 48 and 67, especially, not the Aliyah of stress, but the Aliyah of movement, not the Aliyah from Jews who have to flee from Arab lands, but the Aliyah of people who are coming from European and Western civilization. That's when the Aliyah started to gather steam. That's when Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes. That's when people started to talk more directly about it, Reishit Tzmichas Ruulaseinu, about a redemptive nature to our people, settling our land, restoring our sovereignty. I said that before. I want you all to walk out of this year with all the other traits and attitudes and values. I want you to be proud to call yourself a settler. And unfortunately, in most areas today, that tag, that association, has unfortunately very, very negative and pejorative associations. Now, just because you're a settler doesn't mean you're racist, doesn't mean you're a fanatic, doesn't mean it's you, Chalil Vachas, take advantage of other people's rights. And to a degree, there's a dilemma. I don't know the answers. My settler identity means that I feel that establishing sovereignty over my land is part of the redemptive propulsion. It's part of the redemptive process. Now, there's a problem. There are other people on this land, so I'm not going to compromise their moral and legal rights. But to me, living in this yeshiva, living in a long shvut, I want that to be part of your identity and part of your pride. As you can say, I spent a year in the settlements, and when I come to Israel, I don't avoid the settlements. I dedicate money to settlements. I feel that's part of my commitment to Jewish statehood and to Jewish redemption, is commitment to Jewish sovereignty. Again, everyone has to define how much they invest in one, how much they invest in the other. Obviously now part of our challenge is not just to settle land, but to settle Jewish cities and go back to Haifa and to Tel Aviv and bring the face of Torah back to those who don't appreciate the face of Torah. There's so many dozens and dozens of needs that our people and our country has. So you may choose to invest in one because you feel that's a greater need, but not to be embarrassed and not to feel awkward, to feel like this is part of a redemptive process without coming across as racist. And to feel free, if you're on a college campus, to say, I am a messianist. I do believe that every centimeter of this land will be ours. I don't just conduct policy based on geopolitical rationalism, but I feel I'm a person of prophecy. But all that being said, I'm not going to take advantage of anyone's rights. I'm not going to shoot anyone. I'm not going to steal anyone. I'm not going to burn anyone's olive tree down. I'm not going to take anyone's land. To have that pride that you're part of a prophetic process. To be able to speak in clear terms, not as some crazy Taliban fanatic who's going to bomb people or hurt. To be able to feel that pride and to be able to express that pride. I don't have to conduct my affairs solely on rational terms. And this is a historical process that I'm proud to be a part of. And this is not a participation that was extended to my ancestors. For some reason, Hashem chose me for inclusion. Hashem gave me that opportunity. And when I said that all of a sudden in 1967, redemptive fervor became part of the Jewish identity and the Jewish mind frame, it wasn't just the Jewish mind frame. The return of Jews in 1967 marked a messianic landmark for everyone. That's when Lahavdil, Christian fundamentalism, all of a sudden recognized that this is a momentous event. The return of Jews to their homeland connotes for them whatever it connotes. 48 was a quiet return of a couple straggling refugees to accommodate a conscience of the world that was plagued by the Holocaust nightmare. When Jews return to Yerushalayim, history shifts into full gear. Messianism shifts into full gear. Jewish people have returned to the national and international stage. All of a sudden, all the prophecies of Achris Hayamim. And people have this sense throughout. There's a very famous, and sorry, I just want to make sure you got that point if you need to take a break. There's a very famous phraseology in Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, as you know, is a courtship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his people. But there's a third voice in Shir HaShirim. There's the voice of the female lover, the Jewish people. There's the voice of the male lover, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But very often when the female lover is looking for the male lover, she turns to the Benos Yerushalayim, to the people that are hanging around Yerushalayim. These little girls in Yerushalayim, have you seen my Ahav? Have you seen my uncle? Have you seen my lover? And sometimes the Benos Yerushalayim are favorable. They help out. Oh, he went this way. He went that way. Sometimes the Benos Yerushalayim and Shir HaShirim are very, very hostile. They'll hit the female personality in Shir HaShirim. So Chazal saw the Benos Yerushalayim in Shir HaShirim as a metaphor for Gentile, as a metaphor for the international community. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're hostile. But the point is, why are the nations of the world referred to as Benos Yerushalayim? Why is that the metaphor, the daughters of Yerushalayim? So many other metaphors to refer to them as. Why are they called Benos Yerushalayim? So it's a very famous medrash, source number 7. Davar acher Benos Yerushalayim, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Sometimes the word bas, a daughter, does not mean a genetic daughter, but it means a suburb. Because just like a daughter is a satellite, is an extension of a family, so to a suburb is an extension of a city. So you could call, I don't know, I'll try to break out of my cultural limitations. So you could call Hampstead Gardens, okay, a suburb of London. It's not really part of London, it's a suburb of London. Help me out here. You could call, what would be a suburb of Johannesburg? Any help here? Right, Glen Hazel, well, that's part of it. Maybe Sandton would be a suburb of Johannesburg, and you guys can fill in the blanks appropriately. Okay? So, Benos Yerushalayim, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Sor 7. Asida Yerushalayim le'asos mitrapolin l'chol ha'aretzos. The epicenter of history will become Yerushalayim, and all the other cities will become Banos Yerushalayim. All the other cities will be satellites, suburbs of Yerushalayim. So anyone that's living in Beijing, or Tokyo, or Moscow, or London, or even Sydney, or even Cleveland, they're really Benos Yerushalayim, because even though they seem to be urban centers, commercial centers, cultural centers, they will one day all be suburbs of the real capital of Yerushalayim. So that's a phraseology to refer to people living all over the world. You are Benos Yerushalayim. Asida Yerushalayim Lios Metropolin. V'shar kol ha'aretzos banos. And it quotes a pasuk where the word banos is used in Sefer Bamidbar, or in this case, Yoshua, to refer to. So imagine that. Imagine whenever you step, wherever you will step, in Toronto, in New York, in Perth, in Auckland, wherever you will, and they step, these big city centers, realize you're really just living in a suburb. Because one day, the real center of history, the place where history will go down, is the same place it all began, Yerushalayim. And everyone knows that, and that's why Yerushalayim is so contentious. That's why whatever deals may or may not be agreed upon, it's always going to fall upon Yerushalayim. It's always going to be because in the subconscious and the unconscious of an entire international community, everyone knows that Yerushalayim, some recognize it, some don't recognize it. Everyone knows Yerushalayim is the center point and the end point of history. Everything else is just a sideshow. Everything else doesn't mean you shouldn't be part of those sideshows. But this commitment to Yerushalayim, and that's why it has symbolic meaning beyond just practical meaning. And that's why if you're sitting at a table and you have to pull the trigger on whatever piece of core, which obviously right now is ludicrous because we're not even close to it, but saying in some theoretical world, let's say people would be willing, and it really came down to Yerushalayim, it'd be an easy matter. It wouldn't just be a rational, pragmatic choice if I could save lives. The whole process isn't rational. But in theory, even if you're a rationalist and you feel, well, I'll give up land and I'll make sacrifices, I'll make compromises to save lives, Yerushalayim is not a rational factor. It's not a rational variable, because when you give up Yerushalayim, it's almost as if you give up the redemptive process. Maybe you say, look, maybe we're just not privileged for redemption. Maybe to save lives we should. But it's a whole different dimension. It's a whole different experience, a whole different question. The famous Yerushalmi, Rav Amital, would always quote, I want to make sure I get to the second part, but I just want to make sure you hear all the ideas Rav Amital would express to us about the people in Yerushalayim who used to write letters to the Jews in Alexandria. And as you know, in the early part of the first millennium, right after the Chum Beis HaMikdash, so Mitzrayim was really a cultural center of civilization, and the largest city in Mitzrayim was, of course, Alexandria. They had a really large Jewish population. So the people in Yerushalayim would write a letter to the Jews in Alexandria, source number Chesed, so Yerushalmi, Ha'ibnei Yerushalayim Kosvin Yerushalayim Hagedola Le'Alexandria HaKtana. they would write a letter from the large city of Yerushalayim to the small little outpost, the small little homestead of Alexandria. Now, in rational empirical terms, that was farcical. There were hundreds of thousands of people living in Alexandria, and Yerushalayim was barren. How many Jews were really living in Yerushalayim? But the sense is you just don't measure population and size of cities based on how many people are living there at that moment, or how large the construction and skyscrapers are at that moment, but you have a prophetic sense of. And the truth is, I'll tell you a very, very scary masara. There's a very scary masara that the Sma, it's one of the Svarim written on Shulchan Aruch, quotes, that the Jews of Germany go back all the way to the first Beis Hamikdash, something that historically we wouldn't assume. When did Jews really land in Germany? And at some point they migrated from Spain, at some point in the Middle Ages, but we don't really have record of Jews going to Germany after the second Beis Hamikdash, after Rome, but certainly not after the first Beis Hamikdash. Where did the Jews go after the first Beis Hamikdash? Babel. And the Arabian lands surrounding Babel, where they probably migrated from. But evidently, Jews went to Germany after Gullus Babel. Nebuchadnezzar routed Jerusalem, and Jews migrated somehow westerly, not just easterly, and northeasterly. And 70 years later, Ezra sends a letter to the Jews of Germany, come back, we're resettling Eretz Yisrael, come back. And as you know, the Aliyah during the days of Ezra was embarrassing. Only 42,000 Jews returned, and there are explicit Gemaras which say that if most of the Jews had returned, that could have been Mashiach, that could have been the end. That would have been the end of history. But the reason the second Beis HaMikdash didn't succeed is because so few Jews returned. And what is the Gemara saying in Kiddushin? Anyone know why didn't the Jews return? What was the problem about moving to Israel those days? The economy was difficult and there was terror. That was why people didn't move back to Israel in the days of Ezra. So Ezra sends a letter to all the Jews, and some came and some didn't, but the Jews of Germany send back a very, very offensive letter. They send back to Ezra, you return to Yerushalayim, and we'll stay in Yerushalayim Haktana. We'll stay in Germany, which is Yerushalayim Haktana. And the Masara goes, this is a Masara written in Svarim, that because the Jews of Germany had the gall, not just to remain, as opposed to returning, but to actually refer to Germany as Yerushalayim Haktana, to use that phrase Yerushalayim about Germany, then the Jewish communities of Germany were fated to suffer worse throughout history than any other Jews. It's a scary, foreboding Masara. Because of that, they suffered worse during the time of the Crusades, 1096. All the Franco-German towns, Aspira, Vermeisa, Magens, we read about during the Kinos and Tisha B'Av, because of that, the Holocaust, obviously this was written before the Holocaust, but it's a terrifying tradition. It's one thing if you don't make Aliyah, basically. It's another thing if you lose the sense of Yerushalayim as this epicenter of Jewish identity. That's a whole different ballgame. It's a whole different crime. And that's why Chazal interpret the pasuk here, Shechubra LaYachav, it fuses us to metaphysical, messianic reality. Yerushalayim, redemptive reality. And that's the second layer. Layer number one, the Nisim Interflos. Layer number two, the return to redemptive experience. Layer number three, which I think is the hardest for you to understand. Okay? The sense of Nisim Interflos, you can hear historical reports. The sense of return to redemption, I think and I hope you feel it. But all of a sudden, the repercussions of what happened in 67 changed Judaism across the globe in ways that I don't think you appreciate without historical perspective. One of the greatest events in the 66 years of the Jewish state, to me, if you ask me, one of the greatest, let's say, non-military events. Military events are obvious. They're stark. But if you ask me, one of my top five events, to me, it has to be the Russian Aliyah of the 90s. And it's important because of its impact on our society. I was here in the 80s. I can help you gauge how that changed your country. It basically propelled us from a borderline third world country to a superpower. I was here in the 80s. I don't have to tell you what life was like here. I mean, I would go to the Makola to buy a bag of milk, because we needed to have milk in the sheep. I had to buy a milk. And a bag of milk cost, are you ready? 350,000 shekels on Monday. And on Tuesday, it was 370,000 shekels. Our economy was a joke. Our technology hadn't yet evolved. Today, we are a robust superpower. Militarily, educationally, culturally, economic. I have to tell you, I mean, I don't want to dance on anyone's misfortune. When I go back to the States, I feel the difference. I feel glad to be back in Israel. I feel the economy and the country just works better. Seriously. And you look at the financial meltdown that's afflicted Europe and most of the Western, Baruch Hashem, we've survived more or less intact. I hope it should continue, Be'ezus Hashem. But you speak to Israelis here, and basically they use terms. I was in Ra'anana last year. I was like, okay, Ra'anana maybe is not an appropriate sampling. There are enough people saying the good life is now here. These were people that immigrated from Holland, where the Baruch Hashem Jews are very wealthy. People have a sense of what changed. A lot of things changed. And Derech Agav, I just want you to know that part of it is Shimon Peres, who takes a lot of flack for his political views, was responsible for two major events in the history of the Jewish state. Number one, anyone know? He developed the nuclear bomb for Israel. He led that team in the 50s and 60s that developed nuclear capability, which is, as you can imagine, a major, major event in the state of Israel. And in the 80s, when the economy just got too chaotic, he and a fellow named Yitzhak Modoy became co-finance ministers, and they reined in inflation. They were able to control inflation, which is not an easy task. But what really bumped us forward? In the 90s, if you're going to absorb 1.5 million high-caliber, educated people, it's one thing to absorb Ethiopians, it's one thing to absorb, and that's our moral responsibility, there's not one shred of racism here, but that's a financial strain, and it's a financial strain we should be taking, because they don't bring education, they don't bring a certain style of life that we want to create in this country, and unfortunately, we're still suffering socially. And unfortunately, they're still suffering socially. It's a large protest movement. The Ethiopians are spearheading for racial equality. Unfortunately, the suicide rate, the spousal abuse rate in Ethiopian society, the general social stresses. A lot of the girls, including Shilluk Lumi, in national service, will serve in Ethiopian communities where, because the cultures are so different, if you're an Ethiopian man and you're used to having two or three wives and you are the ruler of the roost, the master of the mansion, whatever your mansion is, whatever you say goes, then all of a sudden you walk into a society where, based on equality of genders, it's very hard for you. And it's going to put stress on your marriage and on your family. And the horror stories are terrible. I mean, my daughters and others like them are spending, you know, hours and hours every day trying to rehabilitate the social fabric. But the Russian Aliyah, these were educated, scientific, enlightened, culturally advanced. Now, initially, the Israeli economy was thrust into cataclysm because you just can't absorb 1.5 million people, you know, 25% of your population in 1993 or 94. But ultimately, the recovery has been spectacular because that is our resource. Our greatest resource is not oil. Our greatest resource isn't gas, although we discovered gas is really not water. Our greatest resource is human resources. And to take 1.5 million Russians into our country, they have dramatically, you know, as much as we celebrate Anglo Aliyah, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the millions of Russians that have come. You go to any store in Ashdod or Ashkelon, you'll see Israeli signs, Arab signs, and Russian signs. You won't find English signs. The only English signs you'll find are in the, you know, Ra'anana, Modi, and Hashmoni. But in the larger national equation, the Russian Aliyah has impacted Israel far, far more significantly in many levels than almost any other region-based Aliyah. Now, why am I describing this to you? Because the origin, the genesis of that miracle was 1967. I still remember in the 70s protesting outside of the UN for Russian immigration, for Russian prisoners, to allow Russians to have tefillin. You can ask Rav Khan about his going to Russia in the early 80s, smuggling in tefillin, smuggling in matzah, getting bullwhipped by a gun on Yom Tov because they didn't want to go into a train when the KGB evicted him. I mean, these are stories, you know, cloak and dagger stories. We lived through this. For 70 years, Judaism was extinguished by the Soviet Empire. No one, people didn't even know they were Jewish. No trace of Judaism. They were stripped from their families. They were sent to Siberia. I remember being visited by my Russian officer cousin, Yaakov, in 1972, I felt like I was eating breakfast with Lenin at my table. The guy had no trace of Judaism. Well, I mean, he was our family, so he came. He came on official Russian business, so he came to our house for breakfast. Like I thought it was, I was having breakfast with who knows what, some Russian vodka drinking bulva. I had no sense of Judaism. And what turned it around? It's one of the modern miracles. An entire people didn't even know they were Jewish. that you heard the voice of America announcing in 67 the military triumphs of the Jewish army, the return to the Kotel, and all of a sudden, like the firecracker, it thawed all these frozen Russian Jews. And that's when the protests started, and that's when the Prisoners of Zion began, and that's when Sharansky and all the others began their movement that led to this great miracle. It's all 1967. It's all 1967. 1967 was not a miracle that was limited to the military battlefield or to the meadows of redemption of the old city and of Hebron. It sent these shockwaves throughout Russia. And I want you to see that in this source. And then I'll talk about a shockwave that went to the west. Source number Yud, Ki'ir Shechurbo LaYachta, the city of uniting people. So he mentioned about the metaphysical fusion that unites Yerushalayim of redemption and Yerushalayim of the present. But it's another Medrash. Amar Yishua ben Levi, Ir she ose kol Yisrael chaverim. It unites Jews, Jews that were so far. Once we are in Yerushalayim, once we have this pride, once we have our army, Jews that have been lost, that have been cast adrift out of the Jewish experience, we're now united, we're now fused, we're now recaptured. Ir she ose kol Yisrael chaverim. 1.5 million Jews that were lost to Judaism became members of the Jewish people, members of Jewish destiny. But it wasn't just a shockwave sent western or easterly to Russia. And here I've been waiting a whole year to talk with you about this. I'm going to take a few extra minutes. Who's speaking after me tonight? Rabbi Blau, is he speaking here? Speaking here, so I have to be a little bit quick. A lot of times, people debate, what is modern orthodoxy? What isn't modern orthodoxy? I'm not going to launch into that debate. But even if you believe that modern orthodoxy is a sham, go back and you see, so much that needs to be improved and needs to be desired and stuff. If you lambast and denigrate modern orthodoxy, you demonstrate that you have absolutely no historical perspective. My Zaidi told me that in 1919, he davened in a great big firm shul in Baltimore. And Baltimore was known in America as the big Torah city that all the Torah Jews came to. He remembers davening in the Frumish Shul in 1919 in Baltimore. He remembers, he told me, he started a club. You know what that club was called? In 1919 in Baltimore, the big Jewish Torah town in the Frumish Shul. Are you ready? He started a club. You know who was in that club? Two people. You know what the club was called? The Shomer Shabbos Club. There are two people in this whole shul in 1919 in Baltimore kept Shabbos. Because the Kiddush Shabbos in 1919 in America, and certainly in London, and certainly in Australia, basically means you have to get a new job every week because it was a 6-day work week. There are no jobs for Shomer Shabbos Jews. Zaidi told me, change jobs. Orthodoxy in America was a joke in the 20s and 30s. And if you asked your average Jew on the street in the 40s and 50s, would Orthodoxy survive in America, let alone, it would be like you're off the wall. Orthodoxy in America, a couple of old fogies, a couple of old Jews from Europe who still like to learn Torah. But ultimately, I don't look conform. Remember, the 50s was a great era of conformity. Watch television shows from the 50s. You'll see conformity, one social ethic, one way to dress, one way to be, blind trust in big government, blind trust in big business. I once was close with a big Rav in Eretz Yisrael. He since passed on. And he would always be uncomfortable with the fact that I learned in a Hesder yeshiva, that I was going to YU, and I would come into his house for Shabbos. He would look at me and say, "Where's your yarmulke?" And my yarmulke was pretty big. And he'd say, "It doesn't count. It's not a real yarmulke." He always like make fun of me and needle me. Always tried to be sweet, and I wouldn't be contentious argumentative. And towards the end of his life, Baruch Hashem, he was able to see that my Torah was serious also. But he was always very, very fanatic. Hesder isn't real, and YU isn't real, and have to be in Panevish. And then I once met someone who says, a woman said, you know that person? I remember, I got an aliyah in that person's shul in the States for my bat mitzvah. I said, what? You dominated that person's shul? He was the Rav, and you got an aliyah for your bat mitzvah? He's telling me, I'm not firm enough. And he gave out aliyahs in his shul. He was the Rav to women for their bat mitzvah. Then I met someone else who said, yeah, I was the chazan in that person's shul when he was a rav in America. I remember we had a microphone for Shoni. I said, why you had a microphone for Shoni and Kippur? And he's telling me, I'm not firm enough. What's the point? point is that Orthodox scene in America was just dead. And once you find scene in his famous tshuva, you can't open cans on Shabbos, you can't open this, you can't open that. If you read the real tshuva, he goes through a whole tshuva, and it's mutter, 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 mutter. And in the end he says, but even though I'll be halach, it's mutter, I don't want anyone to open cans on Shabbos because no one's keeping Shabbos, and we have to make a gzera to reintroduce Shabbos identity to the Jewish people. I said, what does it mean no one's keeping Shabbos? And you look at the date, it's like 1928. No one's keeping Shabbos in America, 1928, whatever, 1938. Whenever he writes the tshuva, so he has to restore Shabbos commitments. No one believed that Orthodoxy could survive. And modern Orthodoxy basically saved Orthodoxy. Because it was a type of Orthodoxy that people could feel comfortable performing. You know, you eat matzah, but you know, you don't have to eat a share of matzah. Just eat as much as you like. It could be a frog, you can go mixed dancing, it's all right, as long as it's in the shul, it's part of the Jewish community. Seriously, it saved Orthodoxy. I was speaking to a friend, someone told me he used to live in Queens or whatever in the 50s. And he went away for the summer to the mountains. And he came back, and he was pushing his carriage with his child in Queens. And everyone's giving him these looks, like, why are you pushing your carriage? He says, what do you mean? Everyone pushes carriages on Shabbos. Oh, by the way, while you were away for the summer, the Rav decided that it was about time that he told us about the Isser of Havaris Dalet Hamas on Shabbos. Because in the past, he didn't really want to tell us because no one would listen. There's no error. Everyone should be with Al Shabbos in France. But the Rav decided to look the other way, because otherwise, everyone's going to leave their phone. We have to have mixed dancing Saturday night in shul, because otherwise, I'll be in the bars with the guy. So let's at least have mixed dancing in the shul. So we can't tell people not to push the carriages on Shabbos, because no one's going to listen. And that summer, they're up beside it. Now I can tell people that it's Asa Minatar. And this poor guy who was away for the summer didn't get the news. So he's still pushing his carriage and was looking at him like, what are you doing? That's what Orthodoxy was. No one really believed. I still believed it. When I was your age, we didn't learn. No one was like excited about it. A couple of old grease balls, you know, in the corner. These were the guys we called the nerdy guys, the grease balls. Those guys, they learned, but we didn't learn during the summer. We didn't have a learning program. What changed at all? What created this vibrant, robust, proud, Torah-centered Orthodoxy that you grew up with, that is a product of the Hesder, that fueled people coming to learn you? It all turned around in 1967. 1967 was the turning point. That's where Torah doesn't grow in a vacuum. If you don't have national pride, if you don't have a national sense of self, if you're not proud to walk around in public with a kippah on your head, you're not going to be proud to learn even in a quiet room. Torah is driven by Jewish pride. Torah is driven by Jewish identity. And that's part of the point where I feel people being very judgmental and accusatory of previous generations. It took more courage for your great-grandfather to keep Shabbos than anything you'll ever do in your Orthodoxy. And it took more courage for your grandfather to wear a kippah in public than anything you'll ever do. And that's when it started. People before 67, they don't want to keep up in public. You know, it's embarrassing. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. You don't want to be too divergent or too discrepant. All of a sudden, 67, we have our pride, we have our people, we have our land, we have our kotel. Am Yisrael Chai, Od Avinu Chai, Hashem's interested in our affairs, Hashem's interested in our needs. Slowly but surely, pride is restored, faith is renewed, kippot come back on the head, and all of a sudden we wake up and we're living in a period in which there's more Torah being studied than at any point since the first Beis HaMikdash in 3,000 years. That turnaround, I've lived through that turnaround. I'm not that old, but I lived through that turnaround. I saw it with my own eyes. I lived through the 70s where Torah was still recovering, was still smoldering, was still trying to get its breath. And all of a sudden, this world that you live in, which it's a given, Torah, it's a given commitment to Frumkai, it's a given. So my first message to you has nothing to do with Yom Yerushalayim is, whatever you decide about modern Orthodoxy, and you know I don't want you just to sign your name on the dotted line and believe that's the answer to all your concerns, because no movement is, certainly not modern Orthodoxy. But whatever your feelings about modern Orthodoxy, every single Jew learning in Lakewood and Mir today owes a debt of gratitude to modern Orthodoxy. Because if not for modern Orthodoxy, I don't think Orthodoxy would have survived those terrible years. My question is, now you take it and move it forward and advance it. But when did that advance first generate its momentum? 1967. And that's what Chazal mean in that last source Yud, every Jew, a Jew in Moscow and a Jew in New York City. Jews in Israel felt it most palpably because of the military salvation, because they stood near the Kotel in Shavuos with 400,000 people a few weeks after the Six-Day War, and a week after the Six-Day War. But a Jew in Moscow and a Jew in New York City, they were connected because Yerushalayim has that ability to connect the spirits of Jews. We have to stop because of the next year. But I hope you're able to take some of these images and really live them this year, and as I said to you on Yom HaSmot, and then live them to the future, even though those around you may not be aware or certainly not celebrating it with the same emotional intensity. Okay, let's stop the lecture.